Did you know that there are 26,500 indicators of a warming planet? Is the great political divide having any impact on climate change? What role do faith-based organizations have in working to preserve the planet? That's some of what we'll be talking about this next hour, and you won't want to miss a single minute. Welcome, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. We are game changers. We are doing the good thing, the right thing, not just for ourselves, but for all beings who call the Earth home. And we thank you for listening and for being a part of our world. And as always, a big shout-out to some of the organizations that help make this show possible. The sponsor for this show is the Chapman Automotive Group. As a company, they are committed to doing their share and showing they care about their employees, their community, and the planet. Their community green team is actively involved in year-long activities that impact both the internal operations of the company as well as the community through their hands-on philanthropy. One example of that is that they have donated almost 2,000 trees to a local nonprofit to be planted in public spaces throughout the city, which benefits everyone. For more information about Chapman, please visit chapmantucson.com, and I hope you'll check them out. Yet another important and impactful show today. This is the fifth and last of a five-part series for the month of May, spotlighting women leading the charge to address global warming. We believe there is no better moment to focus on the issue of gender equality around the world than by raising the voices of brilliant women who are creating positive change by doing the good thing, the right thing, for all of us. Joining us for this next hour is Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. Dr. Hayhoe is a professor in the Department of Political Science and director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University. She is, in fact, a climate scientist, which means she studies this amazing planet on which we live. She crunches data that tells us it's warming. She helps people prepare for climate change. And she believes that many solutions already in our backyards. And I have to add, she is really fun and funny because I've gotten to spend some time with her. So it is wonderful to have you here, Catherine, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
So, on your website, you describe yourself as an atmospheric scientist, and I do a lot of research in the past 10 years. Can you clarify for us what that means, and what is an atmospheric scientist?
Sure. Atmospheric science is a subdiscipline of earth science, and it is someone who is an expert on the dynamics and the energy and the physics and the chemistry of the atmosphere.
Very succinct. from hearing you speak twice and reading quite a bit about you and listening, you know, watching some of the YouTube videos, it's very clear that no part of you accepts global warming on faith. You are a data cruncher. What is the data telling you?
It is telling us that the world is warming. For the first time in the history of this planet, humans really are responsible, according to natural factors, which should be cooling right now, not warming. The impacts are serious and can become even potentially dangerous. And the window of time we have to prevent those very serious and dangerous impacts is closing fast.
So I heard you speak at the University of Arizona. And you said the evidence surrounds us, and this is where I got the quote of 26,500 indicators of a warming planet. And needless to say, we don't have time to cover all of them on the show. But what are some of the biggest indicators that you might think are important to highlight that makes denying the science harder?
Until recently, the biggest changes that we have seen have been happening not where the most people live, but rather at the edges or boundaries of our planet, up in the Arctic or on low-lying islands in the South Pacific. But today, no matter where we live, we can pretty much put our finger on some ways that things are changing, whether it's something that seems relatively harmless, like new species of plants or insects or birds that we only used to see further south, or the fact that the plants and the trees in our backyard are blooming earlier in the year than they used to, or, more seriously, the issue that sea level is rising, coastal and even sunny day flooding is increasing, heavy downpours are getting more frequent, our insurance rates are going up. The risks that we already face naturally, droughts, floods, heat waves, storms, hurricanes, those are still occurring, but they are getting stronger. They're more intense than they used to be. Today, we can see things changing in the place where we live.
So when people talk about climate change, there are the obvious observations that you just mentioned, things like extreme weather, mega fires. For me, one of them is ocean acidifications and the pictures I see about that. Are there some that are not so obvious that you think should be getting more attention? And you mentioned, you know, the insect issue, and there was a great, you know, Dan Rather put a great post on Facebook the other day that someone shared with me about bugs and about Lyme disease and about mosquitoes and the challenges we face with new areas that they're showing up in. And what are some of those, you know, not as obvious? A lot of people are not talking about bugs, except when it comes to the bark beetle, which is very obvious. When it comes to climate change, what are some other things you think should be getting more focus in these conversations?
Climate change affects our lives in so many different ways. And which of those ways is most important really depends on what's most important to us. Where we live, what we care most about. Do we care passionately about our health, about our kids' future, about the economy, about national security, about the birds that we watch or the animals even that we hunt? Our own values are what determine why climate change matters to us. And so that's why I think it's important to talk about all the different ways that climate change affects us, because who knows which is going to be more important and to who, right?
Yeah, and I think some of them are more subtle. Like, I'm going to Michigan in June, and we were having dinner with friends the other night, and we talked about Lyme disease. And my friend at the table has Lyme disease, and I'm thinking, for this vacation, we will be checking our bodies for ticks, because it's something we have to think about. In the Southwest, not so much. We have other big challenges. But, and to your point about, you know, we have Palo Verdes here like crazy, and they are gone. It's done. It's already done. You know what I mean? It's like they, about 6 weeks early. So the allergy sufferers are happy, but those of us that notice stuff like that are not as happy. I'm interested in asking your perspective on, are science in general lowballing the impacts of climate change? And if so, how so? I feel as though I have a, you know, croc in Peter Pan, where the clock, the croc, and he keeps getting closer and closer. Well, there are a lot of days. I wouldn't say I live in fear, but the clear and present danger is very present with me. In general, being with scientists, speaking all over the world, are we lowballing it as a scientific community?
We as a science community are conservative. And in fact, there have been studies actually looking specifically at the changes that were projected to happen over the past 20 years and then what actually happened over that time. So we can quantifiably say that climate scientists tend to err on the side of least drama, as one paper put it. And that is because of our culture. We are actually a quite conservative culture, and we absolutely hate being called alarmists. So every time somebody calls a climate scientist an alarmist, it almost makes them curl a little bit further back into their snail shell and say, oh, well, I'll make really sure that I'm not being alarmist next time. Whereas, of course, the reality is that's just an accusation designed to, you know, make us shut up. Part of the reason why scientists are so conservative is because we are much more comfortable talking about what we do know, and we're much less comfortable talking about what we don't know. And that's, you know, really the way it should be. You talk more about what you do know. The problem is all of the things that we don't know, that we know we don't know, and even the things that we know we don't know, those things all tend to be at the upper end of the spectrum. They tend to be the tipping points, the inflection points, the long-term vicious cycles that amplify original warming due to humans with all kinds of natural feedbacks. A lot of what we don't know tends to point in the direction that we are long-term underestimating the impact of our choices on the planet. And this was the topic of the last chapter in the most recent U.S. National Climate Assessment. So you can find this online at science2017.globalchange.gov. And chapter 15 talked about all of the things that we're not sure about that we know we don't know, and even the possibility of things that we don't know we don't know, and how those are all pretty much biased towards making things worse than we know they would be right now.
And one of your gifts to me is in telling the story without drama, but with passion and engage, you know, getting people engaged, because it's a huge thing. And I have to chuckle, because by and large, scientists are not dramatic. As a group, they're kind of dry, and they're reporting the science, which to me gives them so much credibility, but they're not drama kings or queens, that's for sure.
Exactly.
So what about one of the things that really blew me away and impressed me is that you have taken a pretty strong stand when it comes to engaging with the 3% of climate scientists who disagree that climate change is human caused, and your stance is you simply don't. So I love that. Why not argue with the skeptics? Why did you draw that line in the sand?
Well, first of all, there's precious few genuine skeptics left. A skeptic is somebody who doesn't have enough evidence yet, and who, when that evidence is presented to them, will change their mind. The vast majority of people today who reject the science of climate change don't do so because of lack of information. They do so because of identity issues, ideological issues. They believe that the solutions are fundamentally incompatible with who they are and what they believe in. So I prefer to call people dismissives, in that they will dismiss evidence. And why do I not engage with dismissives? It's because social science research has showed that one of the single most effective short messages that we can tell people is this: scientists agree. If that is the message that changes the most minds, then by engaging in a back and forth 50-50 debate with someone, we are implicitly communicating that it's 50-50, that scientists do not agree. And if that is the number one message that can change the most minds, then I think it's not going too far to say it's actually morally irresponsible to continue to support and to implicitly endorse a myth that many people believe, that scientists don't agree, that actually has the potential to change the largest number of minds.
So they're on the path to extinction. One can only hope. When you said they're getting less and less, it would be a great path. Not that they're physically extinct, but their beliefs are. And it, to me, it's so reflective of what you get to hear about through the filter of the mainstream media. When you do hear a conversation, which to me is not enough about climate change anyway, you would think what you said, 50-50. And they have to really probably search and dig deep to find some scientist that's willing to go on national TV and say they're climate skeptics or deniers or whatever it is. And, you know, it, in terms of the great political divide that is going on in this country and so many fronts, but in climate change in particular, it's almost insane. Do you think it has an impact not just on people's perception of what the truth is, but on climate change itself? Are we busy looking over here when should we be looking right here at what's happening?
Well, the number one predictor of whether people think climate is changing and humans are responsible is not how much they know about the science. It is not how much climate has changed in the place where they live and they've personally witnessed. It is simply where they fall on the political spectrum. The further to the right people are, the more likely they are to reject the science of climate change and to act like a thermometer gives you a different number depending on whether you're Democrat or Republican.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I had to take a moment to chuckle, but along those lines, I have interviewed people that are closer to Washington political scene than I am. And what they frequently share with me is that lots of the Republican leadership really do believe in human caused global warming, but they're afraid to speak up, which, there you go, in any way do things like defend the organizations like the EPA. Do you think elected officials are afraid? Is that something you care to comment? Because that to me is terrifying, that we live in a country now where people are unwilling in their positions with their constituents disagreeing with them, saying, I'm furious with you, I'm disappointed at best, I hate your lack of courage, or I'm disappointed in your lack of courage. What are your thoughts on the fear base in the voices being raised in D.C. and around policy?
Of course. I mean, it's the Bob Inglis effect. Bob was a very, very conservative, multi-term Republican congressman. And as soon as he stood up publicly and said climate change is real, he was defeated in the primary.
So that's the end of the story. Yeah, the money will come out.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the root of the problem, which if we could get to the root of the problem, but there is something that you said when I heard you speak, that it's much more than climate denial. And you talked about solution aversion. Can you share with us your thoughts on that?
Even though people often reject the science with sciencey-sounding arguments, like it's just a natural cycle, or the Earth is always warmed, or, you know, scientists aren't sure about it. Or sometimes they reject it using religiously-sounding arguments, like God is in control, he said there will always be seasons, the world is going to end anyways. Even though this is often the first thing we hear from people, the sciencey and the religiously-sounding objections are a smokescreen. They're the smokescreen for the real reason why over 99% of people reject the science of climate change, and that is simply because they perceive the solutions to be fundamentally opposed to their ideology, their values, their beliefs, and their identity. But if we say, oh, it's a real problem, but I don't want to fix it, that makes us the bad guy. And nobody wants to be the bad guy. We want to be the good guy. We want to be the smart guy. And I should just point out that I'm from Canada and we use guy as a gender neutral term there.
I use it too.
Yes.
Most people are not offended.
Okay. So we don't want to be the bad guy. And so even to ourselves, we convince ourselves that, oh, those scientists are dodgy. They're just part of a liberal conspiracy. Everybody knows the world's still warming after the last ice age. And anyway, it's all going to end when God, when Christ returns. We convince ourselves that this is the real reason when, in reality, if we have a conversation with somebody who's adamantly opposed to the idea of climate is changing and humans are responsible, within just a couple of minutes, they themselves will take that conversation to government control, loss of personal liberties, destruction of the economy, but what about China? It's because the neurons in their brain are right next to each other. The solution aversion is so strong that they don't even realize themselves often that that is the reason why they're rejecting the science. And that's why talking solutions is so important, because talking palatable, attractive, viable, economically feasible and sound solutions, that's what really changes people's minds, because that addresses the real problem directly.
And you've been doing this a long time, and I have only been doing this 10 years, being on the scene and learning and growing and getting the word out and podcasts and social media and public speaking. It seems to me that, focusing on the solutions is more important now than ever. And I don't mean that just from a scientific, everything is, accelerating and there are more megafires and all that, but in terms of giving people a sense of hope and possibility instead of despair, that's the feeling that I have. Yes, there are solutions and we have to talk about them more so people don't just give up. I mean, there's depression now, clinically proven, science reported depression on people checking out because of global warming.
Yes, there is.
So it makes me, it's a part of it why. So we have to take a break in about a minute and a half, so I don't want to get into it, but one of the biggest things that came my way in the past couple of years, and I did the happy dance, is Project Drawdown. It is the most comprehensive plan to reverse global warming, not just, stop it, but reverse it. So I would really like to know what you think some of the solutions are in our own backyard, because you do mention that in your writing and all that stuff. So when we come back, I have lots more questions, pages, in fact. So everybody, I hope you're enjoying this conversation as much as I am. Joining us for this hour is Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. She's a professor in the Department of Political Science and director of Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University. And I have to say, Catherine, I went back and forth because I could read 10 more minutes about the other things you're doing, which I hope we get to cover some of them, because it's really important to me in terms of the comprehensive approach you take, and you're out there and the organizations you're a part of and the voice that you're hearing. So when we come back, we'll talk about the importance of something like Project Drawdown, which is a living, breathing, ongoing opportunity for scientists and people around the world to look at solutions. And then we, of course, have to talk about global weirding. We'll be right back.
Yes.
Stay here with us.
Please join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. You can also find us on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and Speak Up Radio. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or others, please write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But now, back to our story.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for joining us. Joining us this hour is Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, professor in the Department of Political Science and director of the Climate Science Center at Texas Tech University. And I have to put this in where I'm going to be talking to Catherine about it in a bit. Together with her husband, Andrew Farley, this is like the slacker couple. I was reading this and thinking, well, I guess neither of them sleep. He's a pastor, a Sirius XM radio host, and best-selling author of 8 books, including The Naked Gospel. They wrote together A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions, a book that untangles the complex science and tackles many long-held misconceptions about global warming. Once again, thank you so much for being with us. I know how busy your schedule is, and I'm glad we were tenacious and got you for an hour.
It's so great to be here with you. Thank you.
So tell us about, you know, did you do the happy dance with Project Drawdown? I'm sure you were aware of it. It's just, and I don't say that lightly. I mean, I keep it very close to my desk. It's right within arm's reach, because on those days when it's the darkest before dawn, I can open it and read one of their solutions and say, you know, there's hope. You got to have hope. So what do you think are some of the solutions and your comments on Project Drawdown?
Well, I absolutely love that one of their top 10 solutions is the education of women and girls.
Yes!
That highlights the fact that we have to look at the big picture here, and we have to understand that there are so many things that we can do to make our world a better place, that invest in helping with poverty, helping with hunger, helping with lack of access to clean water, helping with local economies, developing countries, emerging economies, helping with many, many issues, and oh, by the way, it also helps with climate.
It was just, and not only that, it was in the top 6 and 7. It was like family planning and the education of women and girls were number 6 and 7. And talk about scientific metrics. You know what I mean? I mean, there's reasons why, and they measured, you know, carbon emission impact and tons. And it was a very, very thorough document that, as I said, continues to live and breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just have to just segue a little bit, just kind of do a sidebar about the reason it made me so, there were so many reasons that finding made me so happy. But when I interviewed Diana Liverman from the U of A, her paper that she co-published with one of her graduate students talks about, I don't know if you're familiar with the paper, but about the underreporting of or underpublication of women's scientists in the global warming conversation and indigenous people. And it was a really, I read the report, and what I loved about it, it was very, of course, factual, based on great surveys and on, but Diane, it wasn't an attacking document. It was more about, this is how the information we're getting can be filtered and skewed because of things like, you know, the government has to submit your work to the IPCC, and some governments don't want women to be scientists, so their work doesn't get submitted. And it's, you know, it's another complex carbohydrate of how we're getting the news that we need to get. And she talked about it's bringing about some really positive changes. So
I would say that gender bias is common across all fields in science. Studies have shown that women have to do more and produce more in order to be judged just as capable as a man. Studies where they send out a CV and all they do is they change the name on the top of the CV, and then they ask the people, you know, is this person qualified to manage your lab, and what starting salary would you give them? There are systematic biases against the exact same CV when it's got a woman's name versus a man's name on the top of the CV. So So the reality is the world that we live in, there are still biases inherent in this world. And those biases mean that when we're a woman, and especially if we're working in a male-dominated field like science, the deck is stacked against us. And that's why I'm so grateful for the work of leaders like Diana, for the Earth Science Women's Network, which I serve as chairing their advisory council. There are thousands of women in earth sciences around the world, in academia, in industry, in the private sector, in the public sector, who are part of the Earth Science Women's Network. And it's this most tremendous support network for women in science that I know has made a huge impact on my life, and I know it's impacted hundreds and probably even thousands as well.
And the ultimate impact or the result of that is we're not getting a full, clear picture, which benefits us all. It's not like sexist, that's awful, yes, the gender bias, awful, yes, but in terms of the quality and the reliability of the information, it's different perspectives, and I think all voices need to be at the table when it comes to, you know, the impact of, you know, women and girls are usually the first hit and the hardest hit, you know, marginalized communities, all of that stuff we know. What about, do you have any other, you know, there are education of women and girls, which is when people have asked me over time before the book came out, and I have witnesses, and I'd say, they'd say, what's the solution? And I'd say educating women and girls, because then they care, then they have fewer children, then they are educated, and the beat goes on. So it literally changes the world in a very systemic and organic way. So I was pretty happy when they came out six and seven. What about in your experience, are there other some pieces of what I call low-hanging fruit that we need to hold on to that are in our own backyard? Does anything come to mind?
Sure. One of the most important things we can do individually is step on the carbon scales. Measure our own carbon footprint. And to do that, you can just Google carbon footprint calculator. They're all over the internet. And figure out where the largest parts of our own personal and our family's carbon budget comes from. It's different for everybody. For one person or one family, it might be what they eat, because the higher up the food chain we eat, the greater our carbon footprint. For another, it might be their commute. So maybe they could consider, should we consider a more efficient car? Next time we move, should we be closer to our job? What about telecommuting? For me, the biggest part of my carbon footprint when we first got married was maintaining our home, because we owned this historic home that had not had new windows or a new furnace for decades, possibly even a century in some cases. And today, the biggest part of my own personal carbon footprint is my professional travel. So if we step on the carbon scales, measure our footprint, then we can make smart, savvy choices to reduce our own contribution to the problem. And then what that does is it gives us something to talk about and share with other people. Because one of the most important things that we can do about a changing climate is what you and I are doing right now, and that is talk about it. Studies have showed that only about a quarter of people anywhere in the country hear somebody else talk about climate change more than once or twice a year. That means three quarters of people don't even hear somebody else talk about climate change more than once or twice. So if nobody talks about it, then why would we care? That's the biggest problem we have. It isn't rejection of the science. It's that even people who fully accept the science do not care.
And sometimes, to me, and I call them the consciousness coma. They're not living in a place of consciousness, because there is information out there if you're listening and your ears are tuned in. And it blows me away. And I go to a place of judgment at times, frustration, anger, inspiration. It's the whole gamut. And I want to shake people who take 8 plastic bags for, you know, 3 candles in a store because they don't want it to break. And I'm thinking, what are you doing? Like, first of all, why are you buying a candle? It's like, unless it's soy-based. And, you know, I have lots of loving people around me that say, okay, just breathe. It's all good. You know, you can get through this. Don't say anything. Which is a perfect segue to this question. One of the things that I think you are very good at in knowing you in a limited way, I understand that, but I've spent hours with you and listening to you at 2 lectures and question and answers and watching your YouTube videos, reading about you. You have advice on how to have more conversations around the issue, especially when it's someone quite frankly, that you want, like, that I have to speak for myself, use the I word, that I want to choke or strangle or say, you've got to be kidding me. The science are there. It's just numbers. Scientists don't care. They're just reporting. They don't have an opinion. Here's the numbers. How do you talk to people about common ground is the key? What's your approach? I need coaching. Mrs. Green's throwing herself out there. I need coaching because it doesn't do any good to get in a, you know, a verbal contest with them. It doesn't change minds. It doesn't change minds.
No. It doesn't. No conversation will be constructive and positive if it cannot be maintained with mutual respect. And so if the person we're talking with, sometimes they might start off disrespectfully, but if the soft answer doesn't turn away wrath, as it says in the Bible, if that does not work, if the disrespect continues and even is amplified, then that conversation is not constructive, and I withdraw from those types of conversations. Similarly, if I'm talking to somebody who I feel I really have zero respect for this person, I cannot identify with them at all, I have no wish to, I just think they're a horrible person, I want nothing to do with them, if I'm having a conversation with that type of person, I would withdraw also because I am not able to respect them, and so therefore that conversation will not go anywhere good. We can only have constructive conversations if we can find out what we appreciate or respect about someone genuinely. And if we don't know what that is, a good thing to do is have a conversation and first of all, ask them questions, just get to know them. You know, see if there's something about them that we do actually genuinely esteem or respect. It doesn't have to be everything, but is there something about them that we can admire and that we can connect with them on because we also share that value? If we can identify that, then that is our way in because then we can share based on our mutual love for our kids, our mutual concern about the future of the economy, our mutual worry about, you know, the economic downturn and people losing their jobs in the coal mining industry. If we can connect over something genuine, we can then share from our heart, not as much from our head, but from our heart, why we care about a changing climate because it affects that thing that we both care about so much.
And to your point, I have one friend, and I'm sad to say pretty much one friend, that through breaking down my own stereotypes, we have built a friendship over finding common ground. Mm. And he was a sponsor for a while. He works for Bosch. And we went to have a meeting about, you know, participating with Mrs. Green's World. And he said, well, you're probably not going to like what I have to say, and you probably disagree with me on all these things. But through getting to know him in conversation, I noticed he loved when he talked about his kids, really caring father, hands-on dad, and he was a hunter. And he said, you probably don't like that, right? And I said to him, you know, Alan, this is where the problems start. I am not anti-hunting at all. That doesn't make sense on any planet. I know my brother was a hunter. My two brothers were hunters. I understand what's happening when you don't hunt. Look at the deer population in New Jersey. I mean, there's like, there has to be hunting. But we made a very good conversation out of he assumed things about me as a, you know, bleeding heart, left-wing, progressive liberal. And I made, I made assessments about him as a, you know, his religion and his stance on a couple of things, and we have had hours and hours of great conversations, and we send each other books and links, and I said to him, we should go on the road because we have navigated.
I agree.
This. We really should. He's just such a great guy, and I would like to think I moved his needle forward, and he has moved mine in terms of it's that common ground. What do you value? Do you love national parks? Do you love getting out in nature? And then the vitriol and the defensiveness seems to like dissipate a little bit, and it feels a lot better.
Exactly. That is such a perfect story right there. You have your own answer.
It really is. And I just have to practice it more because I had a guest on recently that took every bit of control in me to not go back. And the purpose of the show is to find some common ground. So I thought, well, that's counterintuitive. Just keep your mouth shut and keep finding common ground. So let's talk about something really happy and wonderful. And everybody should check it out. Your global weirding YouTube channel. Tell us about it and what are you accomplishing through it? I mean, you have thousands and thousands of views, so it's obviously resonating with people. Tell us about global weirding in YouTube.
Well, we have been running some experiments at conservative Christian colleges to see if people actually change their minds after I talk to them about how we know climate is changing and humans are responsible and why that matters and how it connects to our values. So one of the experiments that they ran was looking at whether it made a difference if people watched a video of my talk versus if they saw my talk in person. And I thought that there was going to be a difference. I thought that there would be a better personal connection when they saw me speak in person. It turned out there wasn't. The video talk.
Whoa, yeah, that's awesome. I mean, that's really awesome. Lines. Yeah.
Yes. So then I thought to myself, okay, so I could travel somewhere with a large carbon footprint to speak to a group or organization of, say, 100, 200, maybe even 300 people. And that whole trip would take multiple days, and there would be one occasion in which I addressed 300 people. For the same amount of effort, I could produce multiple short videos that people could share on social media, not just in a single location, but all across North America and around the world, saying the same things. And I thought, if it really doesn't matter if it's in person or on video, why are we not doing more videos? So that's where the idea for the series was born. And at the same time that I was thinking this, our local PBS station here in West Texas, KTTZ, they had been approached by PBS Digital Studios to ask if they were interested in doing a digital studio series, which are very short YouTube videos on a specific topic or theme. And so they thought, oh, it'd be so cool to do this about climate change. And I was just thinking, oh, I really need to do more video. And so we came together in one of those, you know, perfect serendipitous moments, and we thought, let's do it. Global weirding. Climate, politics, and religion, all the topics that we're told we should never bring up at the dinner table. Let's do it.
I love it. And you just, I'm telling you, I went down the rabbit hole. You just want to watch them. And I have to ask this totally not related to the content, but you're really good. And I'm saying that from my heart. I want to be really good on video, and I continue to practice, and it's a powerful way to present and reach the audience that you want and really, you know, be authentic and speak from your heart. Do you have, I had to ask you this, do you have like a teleprompter? Because you don't miss a beat. Are you just doing this?
Well, I usually don't. So just about every talk I give, I don't even have notes, let alone a script.
I would have sworn that was the answer. Yeah. Woman has it. She's got it nailed.
but specifically for the Global Weirding series, because each video is a single take and it packs so much information into just a few minutes. So those ones we do script. I write them myself with a writer to help me and do fact checking. And then we do record those specifically from a teleprompter, but that's the only time I ever use a teleprompter.
Oh my gosh, I thought she's nailed it. I'm just going to play them now and get up there and practice and try to do it. Because it is powerful. And it is like you're sitting there in my studio talking to me and very just passionate and fun and funny and engaging. And the one that I want to talk about when we come back from a short break, I think it's one of the most important ones, and I admit I haven't looked at all of them, but you did one. It's so important for me that you talk about this in detail, and it's called The Bible Doesn't Talk About Climate Change Right. And it's personal to me. It involves people in my family, and talk about dispelling the myths. I mean, you kind of knocked them out of the park. And the thing that impressed me the most is you really know your Bible. You're not quoting one. You're an evangelical. You're talking to faith-based organizations, and they can really catch you if you're not quoting the right chapter and verse. So I think it's when a video gets over 26,000 views, it's a thing, as we call it very articulately. It's a thing, and it means that it's resonating with people. So when we come back, I'd really like you to talk about what is an evangelical, what is the stereotype about that, and you know, you were honest when you said 28% of white evangelicals believe that only 28% because of humans. And so it's just, there's a lot in that video that's to me relevant, whether you are an evangelical Christian or just a citizen of the planet. I think it's really important. So everybody, stay here with us. We'll be right back with lots of really good information on climate change and a woman leading the charge. Thank you.
Hi, it's Meredith, a proud member of the Mrs. Green's World team. We are disruptors for good, passionate game changers working to create a more sustainable, safer, healthier, and socially just planet for all. By creating podcasts like this one, we offer tangible solutions that inspire you to take action. We need your financial support to continue producing content, podcasts, film, and written works that engage, educate, and inspire our global community to fight climate change. Join us today. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click Join the Movement.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for listening and for being a part of our world. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Joining us for this fifth and last show in a series of podcasts that we are doing, spotlighting women leading the charge to address global warming, is Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. And we believe that there really is no better moment to accelerate the cause of gender equality around the world than by raising the voices of brilliant women. There is definitely a method in our madness for women's voices being heard. They're creating positive change by doing the good thing, the right thing for all of us. And our guest today is one of those brilliant women. Please join me once again in welcoming Dr. Hayhoe. She is a professor in the Department of Political Science and Director of Climate Science at Texas Tech University. And I want to share a little bit more about her. She serves as scientific advisor to the Citizens Climate Lobby. That is really a big deal, my own personal comment there. The Eco America Moment U.S. Project, the Energy and Enterprise Initiative, the Evangelical Environmental Network, and the International Women's Earth and Climate Initiative, and I didn't even cover all of them, but it gives you some insight as to the depth and breadth of Dr. Hayhoe's work. So let's talk about the Bible doesn't talk about climate change right. Can you start off with, you gave, you know, what is it, you're an evangelical Christian, and what typically goes with that stereotype? You know, the climate can't be changing because God's in charge, not us. So just fire away.
So we talked earlier about how when people express their objections to the science of climate change, they often couch their objections in either sciencey-sounding terms or in religiousy-sounding terms. But just as the sciencey-sounding objections are just a smokescreen for the real problem, the implied solution, so in the same way, the religiously-sounding objections are also a smokescreen. And when you take those religiously-sounding objections, you actually dissect them in light of what the Bible says. And evangelicals are people who are supposed to take the Bible seriously. So going to the Bible is a very effective way to look into what we actually believe. We see that none of those religiously-sounding arguments hold water either. So one of the biggest and most common ones is, well, God's in control. So how, you know, the arrogance of people to think that we could affect a planet as big as our Earth when God's the one in control. To answer that, we can go straight to the first chapter in the Bible, which is Genesis 1, where it talks about how God gave humans, us, dominion or responsibility over every living thing on this Earth. So even if you take dominion to mean loot, pillage, destroy, and leave in a smoking ruin, which I don't think anybody should, even if that's what the way you interpret it, you still understand that this verse says God gave this to humans. And then if you go all the way to the end of the Bible in Revelation, there's a verse in Revelation that literally says God will destroy those who destroy the earth. So it's very clear that there is the ability for human agency in this. And then people have a lot of other arguments like, you know, isn't this about worshiping the earth, worshiping the created rather than the creator? And I think there it's important to talk about the idea of gifts, how God gives us gifts. We view God's son as a gift. Then what about this planet? Is that not also a gift from God? And how would we treat a gift from the person that we claim to respect most in the universe? Would we just use that all up and trash it? Or would we actually take care of it and nourish it and be responsible for it as a mark of our esteem for God?
So in essence, people are, it's easy to quote things that are out of context to support their denier position or their position saying, you know, supportive. You can use the Bible as your weapon.
Exactly. Well, tool.
Weapon, that's a much better
weapon
word.
Weapon sort of suggests, yeah, whacking people upside the head with it.
Let's reframe that, please, Gina. I really get it. What about, I'm interested now in you, in terms of your journey, when you say things like, Only 28% of white evangelicals believe that climate change is changing because of humans. And I also think it was important in that presentation that you said only 45% of white Catholics also agree, compared to 77% of Catholics, Hispanic Catholics. So, you know, I was going to say, how can this be? It's very telling. And I was raised Catholic. So about you, I want to know, not only did you get in the percentage of people that know, I want to say think, it's know, that climate change is human caused, but to become such a global leader, and you know that you are, and what happened in your evolution?
Well, I grew up in Canada and in South America, and outside the U.S., there is not nearly the same statistics as there are within the U.S. In fact, I had never met somebody who didn't think climate change is real until I moved to the U.S.
Welcome to the United States of America right now. It's kind of scary.
Yes, yes. So, to me, it was not a cultural or an identity issue. It was not something where I felt or I had been told that you cannot be the person you are and agree that climate is changing and humans are responsible. But as I started to talk with many people here and we started to get kind of beyond the sciencey-sounding smokescreen, I started to recognize that the biggest myth that the largest number of people bought into is the myth that I'm not that type of person. That if I am already a tree hugger, if I already, you know, bike to work, if I'm already, you know, I vote liberal, then yeah, I'm probably the type of person who cares. But if I'm not that type of person, then that's just not who I am. And I believe exactly the opposite, of course. I believe that, first of all, if we're a human living on this planet, then we're just the right person to care because this is the only home we have. And then second of all, I believe that if you believe that this planet has been given to us by God and we have been made responsible for this planet by the God of the universe, then even more we should be out at the front of the line making sure that we're taking care of this precious gift that we've been given. But that's not the way people see it because that's not what they've been told. And so that's why I became so passionate about sharing with people from the heart, not just from the head, but from the heart, about why I care and why I think that they would care too.
And you also, you're giving me like these perfect segues. It's like we scripted this. Because my next, it is awesome. Sometimes things just work. It leads to the point you made in the video. I can't believe I'm going to get a little bit emotional, which is like about the fourth time in 10 years. But the Bible, the main theme of the Bible, and I'm not an expert like you are. I would be a hypocritical to even hint at that. But there is a lot about love. The Bible says a lot about love, about caring for our fellow human beings, about caring about the less fortunate. Tell us how you wove that into the conversation and why it relates to climate, the climate change conversation.
I think that it is absolutely central because the number one reason why I care about a changing planet is because it affects people. It affects living things. It affects especially the poorest and most vulnerable of this world who are already suffering from poverty and hunger and lack of access to clean water. It affects people who are suffering today. And if we believe that we are to love others as we've been loved ourselves, if we have even the tiniest grain or shred of compassion for our brothers and sisters, no matter who they are, no matter who we are, no matter where we live or what we believe, then love is really at the core of acting on climate.
And it goes to the question of how we are treating climate refugees as a global community. We don't need to go wax poetic about the United States and our stance at this point. But I interviewed this woman named Alexandra Bilak from the International Displacement Monitoring Center as part of this series. And we agree that one of the most least talked about in the political arena is a lot of the refugee situations are climate change related. You just don't hear it, even in Syria. And she said, you know, there's no coverage of sub-Saharan Africa about what's happening there, but it is at the root of a lot of the political and violent unrest. It's climate change. It's people starving. It's habitats being destroyed.
And what's worse is there is no category for climate change refugees under the United Nations.
Right. The UNHCR has not added that to the list. And it's really, it's, you know, from I'm talking about it. Mrs. Green's World is talking about it. And, mm-hmm. you know, hopefully our hundreds of thousands of listeners are going to start demanding more of the information, getting it to us about what's going on. So what does it mean to be politically evangelical?
Well, politically evangelical often, unfortunately, means the opposite of theologically evangelical. If we truly believe what the Bible says and takes it seriously, then we are people who feel responsibility for this planet, who love and care for others, who prioritize the needs of the poor and vulnerable over our own, who love our neighbor as ourselves. That's the type of person we are if we are theologically evangelical. We are here to carry out God's work in the world. Sadly, however, these days, evangelical has become synonymous with the type of politics that is about, not to put too fine a point on it, greed and selfishness.
Yep.
It's about what I can get, what my buddies can get, short term, and we do not care if we leave the world or society a smoking ruin as long as we got what we needed. And that is the absolute opposite of what we believe as evangelicals.
Such an important thought for all of us. Whether you're an evangelical or not, it's going to hurt those we love if it isn't already. Okay, what about this one? I hear lots of scientists talk about, and I'm reading about and learning more about, shifting the conversation a little bit now and maybe more in the future about, yes, there are 97% of scientists that believe it's human-caused climate change. But a lot of scientists are talking about, we better start talking about climate adaptation because it's here and people are being displaced, people are dying. Do you think we need a shift in the mindset about how we start talking about adaptation to survive? What are your thoughts on that?
So as John Holdren, who was the former president science advisor, said, he said, we have three choices: mitigation, which is reducing our emissions, adaptation, which is preparing for a very different future, and suffering. And then he went on to say, we are going to do some of each. It is not a choice of A or B.
Either or.
We are going to do some of each. And he continued and said, the only choice we have is how much of each, because the more and the faster we reduce our emissions, the less adaptation is needed and the less suffering there will be.
So it is both. It's not an either or. I think that's really important because we have to get, we've got to get going. So without waxing poetic about who you are and how much respect I have for you and your brilliance, your ability to articulate, do you have a sense of what kind of impact that your important message is having? And I don't say that to your ego. I say that to your passion and your commitment. Are you changing minds?
Well, we have data that says that I am.
Yes, I love it. And you're a scientist and you're a data cruncher. So yes, tell me, do tell.
Exactly, yes. So we're running studies at conservative Christian colleges and universities in various parts of the country and up in Canada, doing pre-surveys and then post-tests and then even delayed post-tests to see if people change their minds after watching a video that I've done, as I was talking about earlier, or going to a presentation that I've given. And the good news is, yes, we do see change happening, which is really amazing.
And opening minds. It's so important. And I had somebody on, I believe he was from like Montana Wildlife Fish and Game, and that's a very divisive state. And he did a lot of what you do. He spoke to people's hearts, and he would go in, and there were hunters and fishermen who have so much at stake in the global warming conversation. And he would start by asking questions and just totally, you know, put down their defenses, not coming in, you know, I am the expert, I have the science, I know what's happening, but really finding out what they care about, and then had the tools and the data and the science to back what he was going to talk about, and saying, you know, here's this river, do you know the pollution measure, blah, 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 and the fish that have already disappeared. So I think the approach, you know, my mother used to say to me, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. And it stuck. It really stuck. So I learned how to say things better. This is a very challenging time for me, I admit. So I loved your coaching. So I have two more really important questions that I want to ask you, that you may or may not, one you may or may not want to comment on. Given what I think is the almost impossible to believe direction of the current administration in Washington, how much harm do you believe there will be or that is being done by some of their decisions? And one example that just haunts me on a regular basis is the possibility of uranium mining at Bear's Ears in Utah, if it actually happens. And I've said on the air before, that is a Humpty Dumpty to me, because once that falls apart, there's no putting Bear's Ears back together again. And it's uranium. It's not like it's copper, where it's not a toxic material, but it's uranium. So what are your thoughts on, I don't want to live in a place of fear of the permanent damage that can be done. Can you balance that out, or what's your perspective?
Well, we have a global weirding episode about this called Messaging with Fear Doesn't Really Work.
I'm writing it down.
Okay, yes. Global weirding, messaging with fear. Does versus hope, what works? And the answer, of course, is a balance. We have to be realistic about what is happening to our planet. But at the same time, we have to recognize that smart choices that we make now and in the future can avoid worse impacts. Our choices really do make a difference. We're not absolutely locked in here. Some amount of damage is inevitable, as if we've been smoking a pack of cigarettes a day for, 300 years since the Industrial Revolution. Some amount of damage we will not be able to get over. It is inevitable, and we have to prepare and adapt for it. But an even greater amount of damage is avoidable by acting now. And why and how can we act, especially when such discouraging news comes out of Washington every day? By talking about it and by sharing our concerns with people so people understand why this is important. Because if nobody knows why this stuff is important, why would anybody support action?
And it's so important to me, as part of that message, the call to action is for people to get involved at the local level. There's a lot of really good mm-hmm. grassroots things happening at the local level, which will change mm-hmm. policy. They're challenging Washington, and to me, that is one of the calls to action. So the last question, and I just want to forward promote the next two shows we have coming up so that you can literally have the last word. We have a Down to Earth with Tim Sibley and Philip Gibson, Indoor Air Quality, What Lies Within and Why It Matters. It's all about what's in your home. And then on June 5th with Jamie Beck Alexander and Glenn Beck, not that Glenn Beck, the conservative naturalist and the environmental hypocrite, a daughter-father team that has navigated they're on opposing views, and it'll be a very interesting show. My last question is, what gives you hope? What gives you hope? Because I know you have hope.
The science is not what gives me hope. Every time we look at what's happening to our world, it looks like it's happening, faster or to a greater extent than we thought. But what does give me hope is looking at what people are doing, because people are doing amazing things, whether it's Sub-Saharan Africa, where pay-as-you-go solar is helping people access energy when they never had any to begin with, whether it's the fact that China leads the world in clean energy technology, whether it's right here in Texas, where we have army bases and entire towns going clean to save money, which is great. I see hope in what is happening to us all around us, and that is why it is so important to talk about it, and that is why it is so important to do what we can so other people can see us doing things, because we cannot continue without hope. Without hope, we will be a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so, for example, on my Facebook page, I try to make sure I post at least one hopeful story every week, because hope is active. We have to go out and look for hope. It doesn't come to us. If we're just sitting there waiting for whatever messages come to us, those messages are going to be fearful and scary, and they're going to be about depressing things. If we want the good news, we have to go out and look for it, but it's worth it because that's what gives us hope.
That's the takeaway. Look for hope. Catherine Hayhoe, you give me hope. Thanks for showing up in my world.
Thank you so much for having me.